listening to the Save the Marriage podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hi, this is Lee Baucom. What do you do when you find yourself completely stuck in a place of reaction? That place of fear, that place where you can't get to the place you want to in your relationship? Well, today, I'm going to have a discussion with Nina Potter, one of my coaches on staff. Nina works with people every day, helping them to make that shift. And we're going to talk about exactly how to do that, including three major shifts. These shifts are going to take you from that reactive fear place to a place of responding with love. If that sounds like something that's important to you, listen in on some tools and some ways of making that shift. So let me start with a bit of an admission. Sometimes I can be a little reactive when I'm hearing some feedback. And so some years back, I was working on getting my scuba instructor certification. And part of that process was to be in front of a class presenting the lesson and having another group of instructors tell me just how well or how poorly I had taught that class. And so I was staying with my instructor buddy there. We had a motorhome that we had pulled up to this place. So we were right behind the scuba store, and I spent all evening working on this presentation, and I thought it was the best presentation. So I proudly stood up there with my PowerPoint behind me, and I clicked through the slides, and I did my whole story, my whole spiel, and they listened. At the end of it, I sat back waiting for them to tell me how wonderful that had been. And instead, they told me exactly where I needed to improve my performance. And I remember the first thing that happened was my first words were to defend myself. You know, the first words out of my mouth were to try to tell them why they were wrong about the feedback. And I was about a half a sentence in, and I remembered that feeling. I remembered what I was feeling on that point. It was fear. And so my response was coming out of a place of fear, not out of a place of wanting to learn. It wasn't coming out of a place of really even respecting what they were saying. And I remember saying, wait a minute, I'm going to start this over again. I want to hear your feedback, and I'm just going to sit here and listen to it. And what happened in that shift was powerful because it taught me things not about so much about teaching scuba, but about how we often go into those stressful situations. And so part of what we're talking about today is how we make these shifts. That you've heard me talk about fear. That was a moment. Here I am in front of all of these people about to judge me, of being at a place of fear. And what I shifted to was a place of learning. And what we're talking about is not so much a place of learning, though Nina is going to talk about that too, but how you go from fear to love. So that's our topic today. And Nina has three shifts that can make. And those three shifts are how you move from reactivity to responsive. There's not a responsivity word that we may have just created one, but how to respond. So how to go from reaction to response. So Nina, thank you so much for being here. Let's talk some about what you mean. Let's talk first about what you mean by the reactivity and the responsiveness. And then we're going to talk about those shifts. So what's the reactivity? What's the fear about?
Well, that's where we're going into that. There's a part of our brain that's programmed to look out for things that are dangerous. And, you know, we want to be loved. We're biologically programmed to want to be loved and cared for because we needed to be in order to survive. So when that fear comes up, it's very compelling. And what we'll do when we're in that fear place is we'll react. We'll react without thinking. We'll lash out. We'll get defensive. If you've ever noticed, if you go back and think about every time in your life you've ever reacted out of fear, it probably never went well and certainly didn't get the reaction that you were looking for. So what I'm proposing is that when we respond from a place of love or with love, we will very often get the reaction that we actually do want. not all the time, but we certainly will have someone who's a lot more receptive to it, and we feel better about ourselves and who we are. Whenever you've reacted from fear, you usually walk away from it not liking yourself, not feeling good about who you're being. You certainly don't feel good about the other person, but you also don't feel good about yourself. So when we attempt to overpower someone because we're in that place of fear, we don't get what we most need. So it pushes away what we need instead of bringing it toward us and getting what we need.
Okay. And so a couple of very important points in there. One, you talked about that trying to kind of overwhelm, mm-hmm. Which is really a good way of talking about fight or flight. You know, you're at the place where fear takes us to fight or flight. That really is. Mm-hmm. And when I was on stage being criticized, I was in fight mode. I could have also been in flight mode. There was somebody else who did that same presentation and had to run off to the bathroom because that was their response to the exact same thing. I was in fight mode. She was in fight mode or flight mode, but those are both coming from that brain place. So you've already named the two pieces of our brain, that deeper part of our brain that's about survival and the top part of our brain that's about love or appreciation. And that what we're really talking about is how we make that shift between the two places. So let's safely assume that if you're involved in a marriage crisis or a relationship issue, it's very easy to be wrapped up into that fear. Mm. And the fear is a self-perpetuating piece. So we're talking not just about every now and then reactivity, but a constant state for couples.
Yeah. And that creates a spiral down in the relationship. And what we want to do is get the relationship spiraling back up again. And that's what responding with love will do. Reacting from fear spirals it down and makes it continuously worse. Responding with love will turn it around and bring it back up again.
So is it fair to say that the reactivity is automatic and the mm-hmm. response or responding is the choice to be made?
Exactly.
Okay. Let's talk about it.
Let's
go ahead and just go through these shifts one at a time.
Okay.
What's the first shift?
The first shift is to build resilience, because if you'll notice, when you're in that reactive mode, it's because you might be tired, you might be hungry, you might be stressed. But what I find is that it's usually when my battery's low. And I think everyone can relate to this. You sort of have this inner battery of energy. And when that runs out or it's low, It's even more hard to not react. In fact, you could be in a very loving place with your batteries full, and it might be easy to respond with love because you're rested, you're fed, you're feeling warm and fuzzy. It would be a lot easier. But the reality is we're seldom in that place. The realities of our Western culture are that we're usually stressed in some of those areas. So building resilience throughout the day will allow you to have a capacity to respond, because you're not just empty, and you have more more reserves, if you will. So building resilience is one of the first ways to shift that. And there is a wonderful example from HeartMath. The Institute of HeartMath is a scientific organization that they scientifically measure heart rate variability and see when you're coherent. But the important thing is they have a really practical tool. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to add that at the end of the call, if you'd like, and I'll walk everybody through it. It takes about 5 seconds to do, if that. And that's what I like about it, is it's instantaneous. You can do it right when you're talking to someone. In fact, I'm doing it right now, and I don't know if you'll even notice it, the difference in my voice.
Well, Nina, why don't we go ahead and tell them?
Okay.
Go ahead and go through that exercise.
Great. So if you just slow your breathing down for just a moment, just slow it down. And Lee, I know you've taught a lot about belly breathing, and that is so amazing. It's so helpful. And this is going to take it just to the next level. So as you slow your breathing down, your eyes open, you're interacting with someone, you just become aware of your heart. So you might want to put your fingers there or a hand there. Other cultures have actual greetings where they touch their heart, either with a mudra or they put their palm on their heart. But in Western culture, we can just, you know, fiddle with the button on our shirt if we want. But sometimes that helps. But it's an instantaneous, you just become aware of your heart while you slow your breathing. And it does an amazing thing to your body. So it goes from your heart, it affects your mind, and it affects your whole body, and it takes you out of the fight or flight mode, and it will start to relax you. Now, if you're engaging it with someone and you don't want to be relaxed, this is really helpful because you don't have to be relaxed in order to do it. Think of it of a gymnast. Have you ever seen a gymnast do something really difficult, but they make it look easy? Or a skater? They're really difficult, but they make it look easy. It's like, wow, she made it look effortless. It's kind of like that. When you're in your heart, and it's very easy to get to when if you just touch that center of your chest, and you can do it instantaneously. You can be talking with your spouse or someone at work or your kids, and if you need to, you can just touch your heart and just put your attention there. No different than putting your attention on your left toe right now. If I said, put your attention on your left toe, you'd be like, oh, well, it wasn't there a minute ago, but now it is. So it's just using the heart in that way. And what that does over time, the more you practice it, and I recommend you practice this when you don't need it, so it's there when you do. That's the key of building resilience. You build up your tank by doing it throughout your day, by going to this heart-focused breathing. And there's a lot more to it that you can learn if you want to get better at it. But if you just want a very basic, simple, fast, this is at the very root of it. So practice when it doesn't count as often as you can. It can be a game. You can teach it to your kids. Eventually, you can teach it to your spouse if they're open to it. And what it does is it expands your capacity. So if you think of, like, right now, maybe your capacity in your life for resilience is like a AAA battery, or maybe it's one of those little watch batteries or hearing aid batteries, little tiny one. You can grow your resilience by doing this practice so that when that situation comes, you've got some way of being able to make that choice to go to love instead of just reacting from fear.
So this resilience thing is, I'm reminded of that, the bumper sticker, I need patience now.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
you work on it ahead of time so that you're ready. Years ago, my family was on a trip out west and we were on the edge of a desert. And I remember the sign, you know, the gas station said, last chance, make sure you have a full tank. And there's one level that you go, well, that's good for them because they're getting everybody. But it's good for whoever is about to cross the tough terrain to be at a full tank. And so resilience is not something you build. You talk about the shift for building resilience. This is something you work on ahead of time.
Exactly.
In the middle of an argument is not the time to try to figure out how to belly breathe and what it feels like to become aware of your heart or to make sure you're rested or whatever. The building resilience is a shift made ahead of time.
Yeah. And it's got some secondary benefits too. The other day, I had like 25 minutes and it was a gorgeous day. I'm in Minnesota, so a gorgeous day is a big deal here. You want to take advantage of it. And I wanted to do a quick run in the park, you know, do quick intervals. And I knew I could do that, but I needed to replace the battery in my clock. Speaking of batteries again, the clock wasn't working the night before, so I missed the battery store hours. So I had to do it now because the clock wasn't working and I missed my chance. So I go in and of course there's a line and I'm feeling the impatience rising because I've only got this 25 minutes and I want to get out there and I want to get my run in and there's two people and they're taking forever. And I stopped and I went, oh, I'm going to practice my resilience right now. So I stopped. Instantly dropped into feeling in my heart. And before I knew it, I was chatting with the people in front of me, having a good time, enjoying myself. And what happened is because I had been practicing this, when I got out the door, I found myself anchored to feeling gratitude for my legs and for the fact that the battery store was on the way to the park and for the fact that the park was so close to my house. And pretty soon I was more grateful when I stepped back into my door than I would have been if I hadn't been in that situation. Now that's a pretty big secondary benefit. When you can create a form of resilience that helps you to be in a better place when you get home than you would have been if it hadn't happened.
That particular piece that about building resilience really is about choosing to make a shift away from kind of a lack of a scarcity piece to what's available, what to be thankful for.
Yes. And that brings me to the second shift, and that is shifting into an intention to learn versus controlling or defending yourself or convincing. The reason I'm bringing this in here now is that we have filters, and we filter everything through our filters. And a lot of us have filters for criticism where we just hear it wherever, whatever's coming out of our spouse's mouth. If we're seeing our spouse as an enemy instead of an ally, we're using that filter of them. Well, if they were an enemy, this would mean this. And we're meaning-making creatures. We make meaning out of everything. What did that look mean? What did that word mean? When I'm working with clients, I'm always amazed at some of the meanings they create when they tell me what their spouse said. I'm like, wow, I can think of 8 different things that could have meant, but they picked the one that they're used to because of their filter. That filters, we don't manifest what we want. We manifest what we believe. So taking a look at what are your beliefs about your partner? What are your beliefs about yourself? And what are your filters? So that you can start to get a grasp of what are you bringing to the table before they even open their mouth?
And that's, you talked about the defending, the convincing, the controlling, all of those pieces that are the reactive piece. Those are tied into wanting to maintain the paradigm, as I would call it,
yes.
The filters, the paradigm, and to make sure that the other person's paradigm of you is what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And when that breaks down, that's when all those pieces start coming together.
Yeah. And we're trying to get what we want because, you know, when our partner is coming home or we're coming together for the first time in the day, we're oftentimes in a mode of trying to get something from them. We're trying to get their approval or we're trying to get love from them. We're trying to get something from them. And of course, that never feels good to them. So when we come to them with an intention to get something, that's another one, along with intending to control them or defend ourselves, or it might be an intention to convince them. And oh, I know all of our clients can probably come up with a time when they've wanted to win. They just wanted to win. And it gets in the way. When we come to our spouse with that attitude ahead of time, they're not going to give us the responses that we're looking for. We need to generate those within us. We need to be feeling good about who we are before we enter the interaction. Mm-hmm. When we like ourselves, we end up liking them.
And this, you know, it is interesting because I was writing some this morning about mm-hmm. this whole convincing, that convincing never works. And you pointed to a piece that I didn't really highlight, that the reason convincing doesn't work is because it's tied to winning. Mm. And we all do want to win. And so there is that little dynamic, the psychological reactance, as the psychologists call it, where even if you agree with something, you're going to argue against it if you feel it's being forced upon you. And that's part of what gets in the way. So the reason that this, the reacting that way, the reacting of defending or convincing or controlling gets in the way is because it puts the other person in the opposite viewpoint. They have to convince of the opposite. They have to defend themselves. They have to try to control in order to maintain their space. In other words, to try to win or at least not lose. And so it locks you into this tug of war. So let's talk about how you make that shift. How do you shift to an intention to learn?
With curiosity. When you can get curious, instead of trying to push your agenda, if you can get curious, and there's something I love to teach, where when you've got a disagreement about something, if you know you're going to have a disagreement about something, and you might not even be going to have a disagreement about it, but if that's your filter and that's where you're coming from, if you're coming from that place already that I know they're going to disagree with this, you're already setting your partner up to react from fear. Mm-hmm. So if you can come to that with a curiosity and find out what their perspective is first. So how I explain this with clients is, if you're sitting across the table from each other and whatever the issue is that you're disagreeing about was on a piece of paper there, if you're looking at that piece of paper, there's a great big six written on it. No question it's a six. If you had 100 people standing behind you, they'd say, yep, that's a six, Nina. You're right. He's wrong. And of course, your partner's across the table seeing that great big nine written on the piece of paper, and they've got 100 people saying, yep, you're right. She's wrong. So whenever you find yourself in a situation where you know, okay, they're going to disagree, or there's going to be something coming up here, or even if they present it to you and you're realizing, I'm disagreeing with this, if you can go to curiosity and just hold off on making them wrong for a moment, go to curiosity, you have three opportunities to win. Now, and I'm sure if any of you think about any time you've ever tried to make your partner wrong, was there ever once that you ever won? Lee, did you ever win once when you tried to make Kathy wrong?
I don't win those anyway.
Well, no, and you can't. Really, we can't. We can't. Whenever we try to make our partner, we never. Yeah. So I'm offering three ways you can actually win instead of 100% chance of losing. So by getting curious, you find out what is it that they're, how are they seeing this? How are they seeing this as a nine? I'm not seeing the nine. How are they seeing it? Once I've heard how they describe it, I hear their language, I see what their analogies are, and now I'm able to see this from two perspectives. But what happens is they're feeling heard now. So when your partner's feeling heard, do you think you're going to be a lot more connected?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I talk about is that the difference between agreeing and understanding.
Yeah.
The problem is that when we're trying to force somebody to agree, that's what you're doing. Mm-hmm. It's that defending, convincing, controlling. Understanding, you know, I can understand where somebody's coming from mm-hmm. and completely disagree with them. Mm-hmm. And at the end of a conversation, if somebody can make sure that I've been heard, they can say, okay, I get that. I just don't see it that way. I'm kind of good with that. That's mm-hmm. been a good conversation. So, and so what you said, find out how they see it. My suggestion is almost exactly that phrasing to say, can you help me understand how you see it that way?
Yes.
Which is partly in how you intonate that, because I could say it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. How could you possibly see it that way? And it's not going to get a good response. Or how do you see it that way? Not going to go so well. But a neutral tone, can you help me understand how you see it that way, can lead to that curiosity place.
Yeah. And now once you've heard it, you're wiser, because now you have two ways of looking at it. Mm-hmm. You've got your way, which is the right way, and you've got their way, which is their right way, and you're smarter and wiser. And you've got a partner that's now feeling connected to you instead of adversarial, because you've heard them. And if they're hearing you and they're feeling, I mean, if they're feeling heard and they're feeling more connected, and you now know how they're looking at it, does it make sense that you've got a way better opportunity now when you present your perspective, that they're not only going to hear it, but they're going to hear it in a way that you're presenting it in their language, mm-hmm. in the way that they're thinking about it?
And it turns out it's both a nine and a six.
Exactly.
All right, good. So the first one, find out how they see it. Mm-hmm. What's the second one?
Find out how they see it. Recognize that you're now smarter and wiser.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then using how they presented their perspective in explaining your own perspective. So shifting how you would present your own point of view into a way that they can receive it better because you're using their words, their analogies, and their perspective.
Okay, and I want to clarify one piece of that, because the danger of that is saying, oh, I'll use their language to argue my point.
Yes.
And you become a debater, rather than recognizing that there is a logic to how they're seeing it and that can help you understand how to have a communication.
Great clarification.
We don't want to create better debaters.
Right, right. Yes.
Okay, super.
Certainly not masterful ones.
Yeah, no.
Yes.
And that's always my concern when we teach communication skills is we're just making people better at fighting.
At fighting, exactly. Well, and that's why it all has to start with the curiosity, the intention to learn, and that third point is more of a, it's a side benefit. Mm-hmm. It's more of a, it's not a step, it's a side benefit.
And all of that is, and I guess this helps us pull all these pieces, is to recognize that you're making a conscious shift to love.
Yes.
And if you're making a conscious shift to love, you're not trying to win the debate.
Exactly.
You're trying to build a relationship.
Yes. And going back to that heart-focused breathing, what HeartMath discovered in their studies was that our mind has a very short field, the electromagnetic field. When they measured thinking, the electromagnetic field was very close to our own head. When they measured the heart, and the heart does has neurons in it, like we have a little heart, a little brain in our heart. When they measured the heart, they found that the electromagnetic field went out 5 to 6 meters. So when you're in an intention to learn and to be loving and to respond from love, their heart will actually start to entrain and they'll feel that love. Conversely, if you're in a place of fear, defense, control, they're picking that up too. So even though you might not be saying it, if you're thinking it, they're going to pick up on it. And they're going to pick up on it from their heart. So recognizing that, having the ability to come to your partner with an open heart and a loving heart, you're already winning. Because they're going to pick up on that love, and it will be easier for them to stay out of reaction themselves.
Which is it's part of this whole process where we can either see two people being angry or one person saying, I choose. And the other person might do it too, but I choose to make a shift in how I'm operating. I'm changing from a reaction to loving response. And they're taking back control. You're take over control. Your tool of changing that heart begins that. And you're also, there's a whole lot of feedback tools here, because as you become curious, curiosity is a great cure for anger.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're looking for information to help you understand versus looking for the reasons why they're wrong. Great stuff.
And when we're judging, we ourselves will feel judged. And when we're criticizing, we ourselves will feel criticized. And when we're loving, we will feel loved. When we're responding with love, we're liking ourselves more. So that's a good place to start, is learning to love yourself.
Which is really about that mirror.
Mm-hmm.
You see what you're looking at. Yeah. Whatever you're putting out there, it's coming right back.
And remembering to see when your partner might be approaching you with their finger pointed at you, not physically, but energetically, blaming or criticizing. If you can remember that they've got those three fingers pointing back at themselves, and they're projecting an inner fear or insecurity of their own. This is their insecurity. This is their fear. That can also help you go to that place of curiosity. So rather than defending, getting curious about, oh, well, they're feeling this way about themselves. It makes me think of that little kindergarten thing we used to say when somebody insulted you, you'd say, I know you are, but what am I? But it's kind of like that. If you can hear that and say, well, okay, what is it that they're afraid of? What is it that they're not liking about themselves that they're projecting onto me, that they're blaming me for?
So one of the layering back of this is you've got that piece. And if you have built your resilience, if you're not low on resources, you have a greater capacity of not accepting that projection. Mm-hmm. You also have a greater capacity of holding back your own projection. You know,
exactly.
The three pieces that you're not putting out bad stuff because you've got some clarity, and you're also not taking on that piece. One of the tricks I learned in therapy was always to watch to see how I was feeling as a client was interacting, because it was a great barometer of how the client was feeling. And so I try to pass that on to other people who are watching their spouse. You know, how you're feeling in your spouse's presence may be a really good indicator of exactly how your spouse is feeling. And to be able to tap into that is tapping into that projection process back and forth, and choosing whether you want to keep playing that game or if you would rather go back to that intention to learn. Which is, by the way, really, if you want to rephrase that a little bit, it's intention to learn to be loving. You know, mm-hmm. It's an intention to love the other person. And the only way you can exactly. love anyone is to learn. Mm-hmm. Super. All right. We ready for number three?
Yes. Right. And that is where we surrender to the love that's flowing through us. Very similar to if you think of a baby. Babies are very loving. Now, if they're wet or hungry, they might cry. But if you ever interact with a baby, they just sort of exude love. There's a reason that people are so attracted to babies. And if you ever notice, I think that the best way to really see this is watching the difference between, say, a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. The 2-year-old will be running around freely expressing, and they're not self-conscious. They're just sort of exploring. They're in wonder. The 4-year-old has already developed a huge self-consciousness. And what's happened is, as we grow up, we put blocks and barriers up to keep us safe. So if something happens and we don't feel safe, we put up a little piece of armor around us to make sure, well, I don't ever want to feel that again. So we put up you can think of it as armor or a block or a barrier. And as we get older, we put more and more blocks and barriers. And you compare that 4-year-old to an 8 or a 10-year-old, they've got even more self-consciousness. They've even got more barriers and blocks. Then you look at a teenager, and they're full of blocks and barriers. And, you know, they're just, you know, like jujitsu. they're going to make sure nobody hurts them. And yet, what happens is we pinch off the flow of our own love. It makes us unable to receive the love that's coming to us. So if we're out there all pinched off with all these blocks and barriers, and we're trying to get love from our mate, even if we weren't turning them off and pushing them away by trying to get something from them, we still wouldn't be able to receive it because of all these blocks and barriers. So the third method is surrendering. Now, surrender doesn't mean giving up, but surrendering means allowing the flow of love that's naturally there. Every human being has this capacity of this love flowing through them. It's just how much of it we've blocked off. And as individuals, we've all blocked off different amounts of it. So surrendering to that love in the moment can be the biggest gift you ever give to yourself, where you just stop and think, what am I putting up here? What am I really, am I really being chased by a tiger here? It's like, no, this is my mate, you know, unless they're threatening to hit you, in which case you are being chased by a tiger. If they're physically threatening, get safe, get out of there, get safe. But for most of you, that is not the case. It's just that part of you that's soft and squishy inside that you're feeling you need to protect, and letting down those blocks and barriers enough to let the love flow through you can help keep you out of that defensiveness. And
So what if somebody says, I don't feel it, I don't feel the love?
That's because you've got all those blocks and barriers pinched off.
And so the way to get away from that, let's talk about a couple of things that somebody might be able to do to get back to that flow. Because when you say surrender to love that's flowing, that means that it's flowing.
It's there.
You're just blocking it.
We're just blocking it out.
Throwing the rocks in the stream and damming it up.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So how do we dig out some of those rocks?
One of the ways is by using that breathing. That can help you. Another way is to look at the things that you defend against when you're not in the heat of the moment. Again, this is something that you would do to build resilience outside of when you're in the moment. Take a look at your defensive, like think of the last time you got defensive. When was the last time you were fearful or when you felt threatened in your relationship? And journal about it. Look at, where was I feeling cut off? What was I missing? What was the misperception in that moment? And then looking at where you could see another way, like what's another meaning that could have had, that can start to allow the block to start to dissolve a little bit. When you start to think, okay, what is an alternative meaning to that? Well, you know, my mother abandoned me. Well, another meaning is, my mother had incontinent issues and she was in the bathroom a lot. if you've ever noticed when you get older and wiser, you notice a lot of things that you thought were true, you get a new perspective on. An example of that, my mother didn't want to let me take dancing lessons, desperately wanted to take dancing lessons. And for years, decades, I blamed her. And I thought, she cut off my creativity and wouldn't let me do this. And then one day I was working this office and three of the ladies at the front desk were sewing buttons and what are you doing? We're making costumes for the dance recital. Well, I have to tell you, Lee, sewing is probably the most awful thing I can think of. I mean, I thank God some people love to do it, but I hate sewing of any kind, mending, and I'm watching these women sewing these things on these costumes. I'm thinking, oh, I was just filled with compassion for mother going, no wonder she didn't want me to be in dance. She knew she'd have to make costumes. I couldn't wait to see her and embrace her. It completely changed my whole paradigm. Just that little understanding when I was willing to get out of this place of having this barrier and this block of this blame, I was able to open to that love. And I felt all the love she really did have for me. And that it was actually a very loving thing for her to not put herself into a position where she would resent what I was doing and be crabby.
So, and then suddenly disconnected and then you two are rolling around. So a piece that occurred to me is what part of what we're doing here is empathy, building empathy. There's some research that a very small amount of research, but very solid research that showed that couples who did not do therapy, they did not do coaching, they didn't do anything other than they wrote from a reporter's perspective on what was going on in their relationship. They kept a journal, and their journal was to describe from a dispassionate third person viewpoint what happened. And so they would write, you know, if they had a fight, they would use the names of the people and describe it from the outside. That's all they did. That was their entire intervention. And they tracked them over a number of months and watched their relationship improve. And there are a couple of reasons why that is. And one is that they were building empathy. By doing that, they were building empathy because reporters are supposed to be non-biased and looking at it from everybody's perspective. And so they were doing that. They were building empathy for themselves, you know, as they were taking a little distance. They were building empathy for their spouse when they began to think through all of the pieces. And as they kept this journal, you know, fight after fight, argument after argument, maybe good discussions after good discussions, they began to see that there's no starting point to those fights. You know, they could see that it was rolling from something to another, and you could keep tracking it back. I remember, so I call that with a lot of people taking the 30,000 foot view. You know, mm-hmm. go up 30,000 feet, look down. Now tell me what you're watching. And one of the things that occurred to me as you were talking is, I've watched my son. I can't play video games. I'm horrible at it. when I was young, the video game was a blinking red dot on
Pong.
Well, no, it was, no. We had the handheld devices.
Oh,
you know.
Okay.
Pong was when I was really young. We had these little handheld devices that had, there was sports. They were supposed to be sports, but they were just little red dots that you moved up and down the field. And so my son's operating in this 3D, you know, world of where you can go up and down and left, right, and forward and backward and all that. And so I was watching him one time, and he was playing, he was flying a plane, and I tried to do that and failed miserably over and over. And he finally said, "Here, Dad, let me show you how to do it." And he's flying along, and he's in first person mode. So it's as if he's looking out of the screen of the plane straight ahead and flying. And then suddenly he hit another button, and the other button took him into third person view. So, or second person view, whatever it's called, but he's watching it, you know, kind of from above. And so as soon as he pops up, he sees the enemies over to the left and over to the right. And he suddenly can, you know, shift back and forth. And I thought, you know, that's really a powerful metaphor of what we have a hard time doing as humans. We go, mm-hmm. we're always in first person mode. We're always in, it's all in front of us. And what you're describing really is dropping back out of that and seeing it from just a little bit of a distance. And with a little more perspective to it, not, you know, seeing the forest, not just mm-hmm. that tree, and taking a slightly step back so that you begin to allow these pieces to fall back into place.
Exactly. And that goes back to the defensiveness. If you go back to the last time you felt defensive or felt attacked and you journal about it, just like you said, it gives you that bigger, broader view. And the more times you do that, the more perspective you have, the more ability you're going to have in the moment to start to be able to do it when you're in the moment.
So the only caveat I would have, and this is, mm-hmm. I've seen it over and over. Some people like to use journals as scorecards.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
And so their journal is... and I've seen them do it. Things are good, so they'll take out their journal mm-hmm. and they'll go back to remind themselves about how crappy things are and how it's not their fault. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to journal this way, it's to get it out so that you can take a slightly different view on it and not hold on to it.
Yeah, it's not a journal to bitch about it. It's a journal to say, where was my perspective? Mm-hmm. What was the meaning I gave it? And where did it go? And what was my, what was my moment of hurt where I hurt myself mm-hmm. by reacting in a way that actually ended up hurting me instead of helping me? So the reflection in that journal is about what the alternative could have been instead of the way I did it. Mm-hmm. So it's a practice, and there's an even deeper practice where you do the third person perspective, where you write the way you said as a reporter. And this is kind of interesting to do it if you'd like time it. Like, give yourself 5 minutes to write out the scenario from the reporter's third person perspective. Then you take the next 5 minutes and you write it out as if you were having a conversation with the person, just like if you were writing a script where the two of you would converse with each other. Then the third 5 minutes, you actually write it from their perspective. You write out the whole scenario from their perspective. It's a huge empathy building exercise. And it's amazing what kind of ideas come that you would have never thought of before because of the progression of going from third person then to second person, then to first person from their perspective, you end up, it doesn't mean that what you're saying from their perspective is right or not, but what it does do is it opens you up to other possibilities and alternative meanings. And so that's really powerful.
What's important about this, as is in all of these, is that you actually want to make a shift.
Yes.
Because I know that there are times when people will say, "What if I don't want to build empathy?" To which I would respond, wanting and choosing to do it are two very different things. You know, when we're wrapped up in this fear, when we're wrapped up in the reactivity, sometimes we don't want to make up with somebody. I didn't want to stand in front of my fellow scuba people and hear them take my presentation apart. I needed to, and it was helpful to. That didn't mean that I was enjoying the process. I left pretty bruised, having learned a lot. But part of that was realizing that that's what needed to happen, not necessarily what I wanted to happen. Mm-hmm. So we're making all of these shifts we're talking about are really shifts to make because you know that's where you want to go.
Exactly.
Other pieces to that surrender to love?
That's what I had in terms of, again, practicing. The first time I was aware of this idea of just letting go, and when I just thought, well, what would happen if I just dropped the blocks and the barriers? It was phenomenal. The flow that came through me and the ability. Now, sometimes it's big and sometimes it's really subtle. The subtleness of, for example, just dropping into your heart. Very subtle shift, but if you take the moment and do it, you can actually sense, the difference. It pulls you out of your limbic brain, your reactive limbic brain, and puts you into your higher brain. So sometimes it's just a matter of thinking about, how can I shift into that higher brain? One way is to just drop into the heart, be aware of the heart. One way is to imagine dropping off the block or the barrier. Just imagine putting your shield down. Like if you had a shield, just imagining just putting the shield down. Now, again, you don't do this if you're actually in physical danger. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Run away. But you're not, if you're in most cases, you're not in physical danger. If you put the shield down and allow the love to flow, that's already there. It can be miraculous.
Good. Yeah.
And it'll get past the wanting or not.
And a lot of times that really is that piece where you have to say, what is this serving? Is this serving my ego need? Is this serving the relationship? What is this serving? And that can help kind of break that flow.
It's like saying, do I want to be right or do I want to be happy?
Yeah.
I love that.
One or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any other pieces you want to cover, Nina?
That covers what I was, I'm looking over my notes here, and that's pretty much everything that I had to cover.
Okay. So we've talked about building resilience, which you do ahead of time, rather than always having your resources tapped out, which also, by the way, may mean that you have to say in the middle of a conflict, you know what? I don't have the resources right now to talk about this. Let's talk about this tomorrow, which, by the way, is a good way of saying don't ever believe the don't go to bed angry.
Right.
Because sometimes after you're rested and after those batteries are recharged, the anger is gone because you realize that what was really happening was you were tapped out. So building resilience ahead of time, then deciding to, instead of defending, convincing, controlling, you actually decide to have an intention to learn and focus that on curiosity. And after that, we talked about how to surrender to the love that's there, how to get back to that love that's already flowing, rather than kind of being stuck at and having that blocked up. The breathing, how to use a journal to get you there, and then looking for alternate ways of understandings of that 30,000 foot view. Those are great tools. So let me make a suggestion. Nina is one of my coaches on my team, and she works with people every day, helping them make these shifts from fear to love. If you've been listening and you're going, I'm stuck in reactivity, I can't get to that other place, that's a great sign that it would be a great time to contact a coach. If Nina has said some things that made sense, there's an easy way of contacting her. Just send an email to Nina@SaveTheMarriage.com and just say, you know what? That made sense to me. I need some help. Nina will get back to you and get you some coaching. Nina, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Lee, and thank you for all the beautiful work that you do.
And everybody, thank you for being here and listening. Thank you for taking the time to work to save your relationship.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.